Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Alison Van Diggelen. I'm host of Fresh Dialogues and a BBC contributor. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. David Grinspoon. He's senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and author of Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. Dr. Grinspoon is an astrobiologist and advisor to NASA on space exploration strategy. He's involved with several interplanetary spacecraft missions for NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Japanese Space Agency. In 2013, he was appointed inaugural chair of the astrobiology at the U.S. Library of Congress, where he studied the human impact on Earth's systems. In 2006, he was awarded the Carl Sagan Medal of Excellence for Public Communication in Planetary Science. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Grinspoon.
Thanks so much for coming out. It's great to be with you, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this. I'm going to talk a little bit about my new book, Earth in Human Hands, and read you a few snippets that I like from it. Hopefully you'll like them too. And then we're going to sit down and have a conversation and address your questions as well. So as was mentioned, I think, in the introduction, I am an astrobiologist. Astrobiology is the scientific study of the potential for life in the universe. And so, as the word implies, it's a hybrid. We study the astro part. We use our techniques of observation and modeling, spacecraft, telescopes, to try to understand what kinds of environments there are on other planets in the universe. And the bio part, we study the history and the limits of life on Earth, and we try to map those together to understand the potential of this universe for life and how widespread it might be and how we might be able to detect it elsewhere. So my particular part of astrobiology is planetary science and planetary exploration. So I've been part of some teams, mostly with NASA, of scientists building spacecraft and exploring Venus, Mars, other places, and piecing together the stories of our sibling planets. And a lot of that reflects back on our understanding of our own planet. So, but now, why is an astrobiologist writing a book about the human influence on Earth and our particular time and the transformation that our planet is going through? In this first section I'm going to read you, it's from the introduction of the book, and I try to sort of answer that question and frame my approach to this question. It's from, this is the very beginning of the book, it's from the introduction, which is called A Planetary Perspective on the Human Predicament. Gazing over the countless fluctuations and transformations in Earth's multi-billion year history, I am struck by the unique strangeness of the present moment. We suddenly find ourselves sort of running a planet, a role we never anticipated or sought, without knowing how it should be done. We're at the controls, but we're not in control. This book is my view of how we got into this situation and where that leaves us now. A child of the space age, I grew up captivated by the romance of planetary exploration. My timing was right to become a NASA research scientist working in the new field of astrobiology, the scientific study of life in the universe. My participation in the spacecraft exploration of other planets has informed my view of our presence on this one. In these pages, I'll describe how we humans fit into the long-term story of Earth and how I believe this knowledge can help us to navigate our current time of environmental stress and uncertainty about the future. Although climate change is the most obvious, it is only one of a large number of interconnected ways in which we have suddenly begun to modify the planet we inhabit. The scientific community is now converging on the idea that we have entered a new phase or epoch of Earth history, one in which the net activity of humans has become a powerful agent of change, equal to the other great forces of nature that build mountains and shape continents and species. The proposed name for this new epoch is the Anthropocene, or the Age of Humanity. This concept challenges us to look at ourselves in the mirror of deep time, measured not just in decades or centuries or even in millennia, but over hundreds of millions and billions of years. We are witnessing and manifesting something unprecedented and still completely unpredictable, the advent of self-aware geological change. As an astrobiologist, I study the possible evolutionary relationships between life and the planets that may host it. I see the Anthropocene as a tricky new step in the long, intricate dance between Earth and its biosphere that has been going on for 4 billion years. There are those who object to the name Anthropocene as being too self-aggrandizing and serving a destructive, human-centered viewpoint. But this epoch is well named because it represents a recognizable turning point in geological history brought about by one species, Anthropos. And our growing acknowledgement of this inflection can be a turning point in our ability to respond to the changes we've set in motion. I believe that, more than the extreme and undeniable physical changes to the planet being caused by human influence, it is this dawning self-recognition that is really fundamentally different and ultimately promising about the Anthropocene. Many species have changed the planet to the benefit or detriment of others, but there has never before been a geological force aware of its own influence. Okay, so that's the beginning. I talk about the beginning of the book. I actually go outward and talk about our growing knowledge of other planets and how that has grown in concert with our views about Earth, and how during the space age in particular, we've had several major insights about our own planet that were only possible when we went out to explore the rest of the solar system, as T.S. Eliot said, at the end of all our exploring, we return to the place we started in and see it as if for the first time. That's not a direct quote. T.S. said it better, but something like that. I talk about that, and I say that the planetary perspective allows us to step away from the noise of the immediate present, to see ourselves from a distance in time lapse. When we do so, what we see is not just a problem facing our civilization, but an entirely new evolutionary stage in the development of life. In seeing ourselves as a geological process, we also see the planet entering a phase where cognitive processes are becoming a major agent of geological change. Earth's biosphere gave birth to these thought processes, which are now in turn feeding back and reshaping its changing planetary cycles. A planet with brains? Fancy that. Not only brains, but limbs with which to manipulate and build tools. We are just beginning to come to grips with this strange new development. Like an infant staring at its hands, we are becoming aware of our powers, but have not yet gained control over them. The planetary perspective provides a kind of out-of-body experience for us, hovering in orbit and watching ourselves sleepwalk through a slow disaster of our own making. Now, can this experience help us to shake ourselves awake? For virtually all of its history, Earth has evolved without us, and we have always seen ourselves as autonomous actors on a passive planetary backdrop. But now we are beginning to see that our futures, those of humanity and of planet Earth, are tightly conjoined. If human civilization is to persist and thrive, we will need a completely different view of our planet and of ourselves, in which we acknowledge both our deep dependence and our increasing influence. We need visions of a future in which we have applied our infinite creativity to the task of living on a finite world, where we have embraced our role, become comfortable and proficient as planet shapers, and learned to use our technological skills to enhance the survival prospects, not just of humanity, but of all life on Earth. My name for this vision is Terra Sapiens, or Wise Earth. And later on in the book, I have a chapter called Terra Sapiens, where I sort of develop that vision. Like, what would it look like once we get over this this phase of just trying to get a handle on our reckless and destructive, profligate, unthinking activities? I feel that, and this is one of my major messages in this book, that we don't have the option to stop being planet changers. That, like it or not, we have to learn how to be graceful planet changers. And even though that's sort of frightening, and the title of the book, Earth in Human Hands, is not meant to just be, you know, all right, go humanity. It's something that you know, it's sort of daunting. Who elected us? But I feel that we have to acknowledge that in a certain sense the earth is in our hands, and we have to learn. We have to rise to that occasion. But once we get over sort of the fear and the immediate urgency of adjusting our behavior, then thinking of the long term, it also opens up some wonderful possibilities of being able to be good caretakers of life and ward off dangerous things that would happen not just to us but to the rest of the biosphere without our influence. I'll come back to that point in a second. I want to read a snippet from the beginning of chapter 3. This chapter is called Monkey with the World, and it's about, it's the chapter in which I sort of really describe and summarize human influence and why it's undeniable that we have entered a new geological stage on the planet. So this section's called Something New. It actually starts with a Grateful Dead lyric that I'm not going to read. You'll have to, because really I should sing it, but I'm not going to. But you'll have to check out the book if you want to see that. But something new. Have you noticed that something strange is happening to Earth? Take a good long look at this world, a dazzling blue orb festooned with spiraling clouds, spinning through star-flecked darkness, dayside glinting in slowly brightening sun, winter white pulsing between north and south as Earth ambles through its orbit. Now, imagine you are a very patient alien regarding Earth over the eons. If you've been watching carefully for, say, the last several billion years, you've seen a lot happen. The brown continents drifting around the oceanic globe, coalescing and breaking apart, animated pieces in a morphing spherical puzzle. The polar caps growing and shrinking, advancing and retreating as climate rocks between ice age and hothouse. Throughout all these changes, the night side remains a nearly unbroken black, and the dayside continents are the stark, dull gray of bare rock. After 4 billion lonely years, a green fringe first edges over the land, and the night starts to sparkle with occasional forest fires. Still, for the longest time, the unlit hemisphere remains as black as the starry space surrounding it. The dark, interrupted only by these fleeting fires and by occasional flash of lightning or splash of aurora. Until, very recently, in the last few hundred years, just a twitch in the life of the planet. Whoa, what is this? Something new. Suddenly, the planet lights up in a peculiar spidering pattern that seems to reflect an organic process, but something else as well. Something cognitive? Starting in a few isolated river valleys and coastal areas, glowing points appear, abruptly dotting the night, then stitching together and spreading along widening and brightening webs, hugging the shores and eventually growing in loose nodal patterns across the interiors of the lands. On the dayside, a mesh of dark lines becomes visible, winding between the locations of those nightlights, each swiftly surrounded by a growing verdant grid of novel angular geometry. Soon, regular movements of small wave-generating objects start crossing the oceans, and bright linear clouds start streaking the skies. At the same time, a host of other accelerating changes are observable in the atmosphere, the land, the oceans, and the ice. Finally, just 60 years ago, a blink-and-you-missed-it interval in this fast-forward view, began the curious anti-accretion, with small bits of Earth stuff jumping into space, little insect-like constructions of refined metal bristling with sensors, thrusters, and radio antennae started leaping off-planet, sailing first to the nearest worlds and then to those farther afield, sending pictures and other information home to their inquisitive builders, signaling the arrival on Earth of curiosity and gravity-defying technology. Yes, after billions of years of geology as usual, something new and strange is definitely happening here. What is the meaning of these new changes? And thank you. and then I tell you the meaning, which, you know, takes a few more pages here. And I sort of divide up the... I talk about all the major transformations that planets go through and that Earth has gone through, and I divide it up into four categories. I say there are really four kinds of planetary change categorized with respect to the influence of life. There are random changes where life has nothing to do with it, you know, innocent bystander, an asteroid hits, or there's a big burp of volcanism and a lot of creatures die out. There are biologically induced changes where the evolution of life itself leads to such drastic environmental changes that a lot of other species go extinct. And that's happened many times in the past, that that species have come along and been so successful that they've caused other species to go extinct. There are inadvertent changes, which is basically what we're struggling with now, where a cognitive species, a supposedly intelligent species, develops technology and is so good at solving local survival problems that they populate their planet and start changing it unbeknownst to themselves, and then suddenly are in crisis. And there are intentional changes where a cognitive technological species is aware of its global influence and perceives threats or perceives things that they would like to avoid or create, and intentionally changes the planet. And there are examples of that too. A great example is the ozone problem, where through unintended consequence of deploying some new technology, we started changing Earth's stratosphere in a very dangerous way. We detected that, recognized it. There was a big debate about it. It was contentious. There were people that denied the science and said it was a hoax. There were companies that fought it because they wanted to make profit, but ultimately the truth won out, and there were global agreements made. Companies introduced new products and found ways to profit off the new situation, and it worked. It was a global solution, and the ozone layer is being fixed now, which shows that we have that capacity. There are other examples, well, many of that I talk about as well, many of which are in the future, things that we could do once we get to that point where these planetary changes of the fourth kind, these intentional changes, dominate our global response to the environment. And I'm going to read you a very brief snippet about one of those. This is about asteroid mitigation. You know, the dinosaurs would still be here if they had had a space program. Space defense is ethically simpler than most other proposed or actual large-scale technological interventions with the planet. Here, human interests and the interests of the rest of the biosphere have obvious and large overlap. An asteroid of sufficient size will ruin everyone's day. Doesn't it seem, then, that we have a clear moral obligation to the biosphere to pursue such a project? Why? Well, how do you feel about mass extinction? When I've described past catastrophic die-offs, the disappearance of millions of species due to planetary changes of the first and second kind, do these stories seem sad to you? Are these tragedies or simply nature taking its course, like a fuzzy bunny being devoured by a fleet fox in a documentary? Random or, quote, natural catastrophes, even huge ones, are much easier to deal with than those which are caused and therefore could be averted by us. Because we have at least the possibility of foresight and avoidance, we see the mass extinction that we are currently starting as particularly tragic and feel horribly responsible for it. Now, in this context, think about the morality of not just past and current extinctions, but future ones. If we get through this next century with a stabilized population and a sustainable global energy system, then it may be time for payback. What could we ever do for Earth that would possibly help atone for the damage we are doing now? Maybe humanity can build a planetary defense system to start to make amends for the extinction we are currently causing. As long as we or our descendants are on the case, Earth's biosphere never has to be decimated by another giant impact. Maybe this could be some kind of long-term compensation to the biosphere. First, we need to get a handle on the killer asteroid that is our own reckless behavior. Then, in the future, we may well be able to prevent the next mass extinction. So I go from there to talking about the vexed problem of controlling the climate. And, you know, there are these, I would say, kind of naive proposals that we should geoengineer and not, you know, just solve climate by injecting stuff in the stratosphere or to block sunlight or seeding the ocean with iron to cause algae blooms and suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. These things work on paper, but we don't understand how the systems work well enough to try something like that without probably inducing, making the cure worse than the disease. But so I caution, and I'm not in favor of sort of immediate geoengineering, but I do talk about this continuum of learning to take control of ourselves and then rise to this role as planet changers. And I do talk about how in the long run we probably will want to do some kind of engineering of the Earth. Now I'm talking 10,000, 100,000 years in the future, but people have this illusion that left to its own devices, the Earth is fine and is a paradise and is benign for life. But actually, that's an illusion because we've been lucky. We've lived in this 10,000-year period where the climate's been stable and warm. And we can be lulled into thinking that's the normal state of things, but it's not. Left to its own devices, the Earth would go into another ice age, and it would be horrible. Our civilization would not last, but also a lot of other extinctions would go extinct as well. So in the long run, we would have the capacity to prevent that. And I put that in the same category as these asteroid impacts, that it's worth thinking not just of how we want to behave right now, but in the context of deep time, both the past and the future, what role ultimately could a sentient, aware, technologically capable species play? And can we have that kind of a vision to guide even much longer than the timescale in which you and I will be alive? But that's part of my point, is that we have to start seeing these as multi-generational projects and see ourselves as collaborators with future humans and sort of hold up our own end. And so it's worth having these longer-term visions. I think it's actually vital. Well, I want to wrap up and tell you just a couple more things. There's a section that I haven't mentioned in here yet, which is about SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And why would I discuss that in a book about the human role on Earth? Well, because I want to generalize this question of what does it take for a supposedly intelligent species to survive for a long time with technology and achieve a sustainable state with the planet. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the history and the literature and the math of SETI, it turns out, I think it's the same question, that whether or not anybody is out there to talk to in the universe comes down to the question of longevity. If species are capable of lasting for a long time, then we ought to be able to find some, and they ought to be able to find us. If they're not, then there's going to be no one to talk to. So it's just another way of abstracting this question. Is it possible to get over this hurdle of this sort of technological adolescence, this bottleneck that we're in now, and achieve some long-term stable coexistence, healthy coexistence between an intelligent species and a biosphere? And by thinking about the problem elsewhere, I think it helps us look at the real challenges we face here on the planet. And so I have, sort of near the end of the book, I talk about that question of There's a chapter, Intelligent Worlds in the Universe, where I sort of generalize that a little bit and then turn the telescope back on ourselves. Finally, the last chapter is called Embracing the Human Planet. And part of what I do in this chapter is I talk about feelings about the future. And there's a section called The Power of Negative Thinking, where I talk about there's a lot of human bashing these days and a lot of doom and gloom. And for understandable reasons, we've got huge challenges. There are legitimate reasons to fear and be concerned about the future and wonder exactly where we're going. But I also worry about a sort of toxic and corrosive pessimism that leads to fatalism and can limit our imaginations and our ability to face the future. And I talk about the metaphors we use to describe ourselves are often metaphors of crime and disease. And there's a basis for that, but there I think there are also reasons why those metaphors aren't completely apt. And, you know, a cancer cell doesn't ever stop and go, hey, should I keep being a cancer cell? And I propose some other metaphors. So I do a sort of taxonomy of pessimism, and then at the very end, there's a little bit of, I talk about different kinds of optimism, and I'm going to just read you a section from almost the end of the book. And this will be the last section that I read now, and then I think we're going to have some conversation and invite your questions as well. Thoughtful control of Earth is now a skill that, under threat of catastrophe, we are forced to learn and master. The hardest part of that, it seems, will be mastering ourselves. Rising to this occasion means accepting a new role on the planet. When we step back and examine current trends against the long sweep of planetary history, it becomes clear that our world is now being rapidly remade by changes we have inadvertently caused. How should we respond to this unsettling realization? Even if we wanted to, we couldn't just stop what we're doing, because by now we've made our world of 7 billion and rising people fully dependent upon and deeply desirous of world-changing technology. So we need to find a way to finish what we've started, to more fully embrace our role as world changers, and to learn to get good at it. Right now, the subject of the future is rife with anxiety. Visions of apocalypse dance in our heads. The topic of the Anthropocene is often associated with doom and gloom, with an is-the-earth-screwed mentality. This is understandable, but it's not the whole story. Let's not dwell on these prophecies to the point where they become self-fulfilling. I propose that, on the contrary, the true Anthropocene is something that should be welcomed. Though it is yet only in its infancy, it can be glimpsed. Don't fear it. Learn to shape it. It is the awareness of ourselves as geological change agents that, once propagated and integrated, will provide us with the capacity to avoid doom and take our future into our own hands. Understandably, we are uncomfortable with our role as reluctant planetary engineers. Discomfort sometimes manifests as self-loathing and denial. But this is our task, and we can't afford to wallow. It's time to human up. We have to stand and face it. Get up on our big bipedal frames and look in the mirror. Wake up to find out that we are the eyes of the world. Earlier in this chapter, I described flavors of pessimism. There are flavors of optimism, too. There's cosmic optimism, stemming from a belief that the universe in its vastness bends toward life and intelligence, and that what happens here doesn't really matter anyways because, quote, there's plenty more where we come from. There's data-driven and historically based optimism, which focuses on positive indicators, of which there are many. Poverty, malnutrition, and infant mortality are in retreat globally. Levels of education are on the rise. Communication continues to become cheaper and easier. Population is plausibly heading towards stability. Solar and wind energy are getting cheaper and will continue to do so. These are all trends toward human freedom and environmental sustainability. There's pragmatic optimism. We really don't know what is going to happen, so why not spread hope and encourage engagement? Exponential technological innovation is transforming our world in surprising and accelerating ways. Possibilities that until recently seemed magical are now imminent, rendering the future frightening and exhilarating, but above all, unpredictable. Where there is uncertainty, there is also hope and choice and room for faith in ourselves. I believe we're just getting started on this planet. Okay. Thank you very much.
So, David, thank you so much for sharing your insights. It's really valuable, and I enjoyed reading your book. We're here in Silicon Valley, and I love this message of optimism, and I'm sure we've got at least a few engineers in the audience. I want to back up and talk first about your perspective, because you're not just talking about climate change and you're in the weeds. You have a unique perspective. And one of the things that I found in researching this is you've said that the most misunderstood thing about Earth is that Earth is in space. We all live in space. The galaxy is our neighborhood. Earth is a planet among many, and we ignore that at our peril. So talk about the framing and this unique perspective for your book and how that helps get the argument framed.
Sure, yeah, I think we do tend to still have that illusion that that space is not a place where we live, that it's out there and we're down here. We've known, of course, in a certain sense since the Copernican Revolution 400 years ago, that that wasn't true, and especially with the revelations of the 20th century where we found that even our galaxy is just a minuscule part of, you know, that there's part of a cluster of galaxies and there's other clusters and superclusters of galaxies. And, you know, it just goes so deep and that especially in the last 15 years, the sort of that revolution in knowledge has been completed with the exoplanet revolution. It was still possible, you know, when you and I were born, that there were no planets beyond our solar system. We thought, well, probably other stars have planets because they seem like our sun. And as we understood that the formation of the planets was a byproduct of the formation of the sun and probably happened elsewhere. But we didn't know until recently we got the tools to detect them. And now we know that every planet, every star in the sky basically has planets, and so there's really nothing unusual about being on a planet. And that, I think that perspective is important for a number of reasons, and we've gained a lot of pragmatic knowledge of the functioning of the Earth from studying the functioning of other planets. And I mean, I can give you specific examples having to do with discovering the destruction of the ozone layer and discovering the theory of nuclear winter came from studying dust storms on Mars. Of course, global warming by being able to do climate models of Venus and Mars, we sort of flex our modeling muscles and make sure that we really know what we're doing. So I think, you know, we really can't understand Earth in a vacuum. And so it's sort of almost just in the nick of time that we've been able to go out and really get perspective on our home world. And then, you know, I think emotionally and even I would say spiritually, the ability to look back at Earth from orbit and from elsewhere in the solar system makes us aware of the fundamental unity of our planet, and that a lot of the divisions we accept are, in fact, illusory. And that transformation in thought of seeing ourselves as a global entity, I see, is actually really key to our biggest challenge. A lot of our challenges are manifestations of this larger challenge of being able to perceive and act globally. And I think that the space perspective is helping us, and even in subtle ways. I think just the fact that we now have two generations that have grown up with images of Earth from space as, you know, sort of part of normal life experience is infecting our mentality, and slowly we are becoming that sort of homo cosmicus, which is comfortable with our reality that we are a global entity, and we have to learn how to act like one.
Great. And talk about how you can translate that big picture view into harnessing and changing the mindset because there's a lot of fragmentation over how we're tackling this issue of climate change.
Absolutely. You know, and obviously I don't have a magic bullet for that. If I did, I'd be using it everywhere I could. But I do think that just simply by communicating, I think the scientific community can play a powerful role simply by, in every way we can, sharing what we know, sharing the truth of our planet. You know, when we study the Earth, when we image it from space, and, you know, not just the visible, but all these other wavelengths that are accessible to us now, we see global cycles of energy and minerals and nutrients, and we see that we're embedded in these long-term global patterns. I mean, that's the reality of our world. So I don't have a complete solution as to how to, you know, if I could, I'd shake every human being and or take them into orbit and say, look, look where we live. But I feel like my role as a member of the scientific community and as a space scientist is to try to spread, you know, as widely as possible, that you tell people what we know, tell people the reality of this world we're living on, and that promotes a worldview, which I think is the worldview that we're going to need to survive the challenges that our civilization is confronting now.
Right. I understand that Carl Sagan was like an uncle to you. He was a professor of yours. What have you learned from Carl Sagan about communicating science in an accessible and compelling way to get the message out there?
Yeah, I did. I grew up around, you know, Carl Sagan and my father were basically best friends when I was a kid. They were both Harvard professors, and he was Uncle Carl from when I was about 6 years old.
Lucky you. And,
yeah, this was way before he was famous. He was just this cool guy that my family knew who, you know, did astronomy and would take you to look through the telescope and bring pictures of the new shots of Mars from the Mariners, and you know I guess he was a very inspiring and sparkling presence. I would say even more so in private than his public persona. You know, he was just infectiously enthusiastic about the universe and loved people and loved communicating. And I guess you asked what I learned about communicating from him. It's an interesting question. One thing I would say is that he never talked down to people. He really respected the native intelligence of everyone and of kids, definitely, you know. And that's one thing that when I talk to groups of kids, I'm just always blown away by how smart they are and how much they know. And so I think the best communication comes from sort of a deep respect for whoever it is that you're trying to reach.
Good. And you talk in the book about this Anthropocene era and the dilemma we're in. Can you expand on what you mean about this dilemma?
Yes, the Anthropocene dilemma is my term for the fact that we are now acting in a wider sphere than our awareness. So it's when I talk about the third kind of planetary change, which is the inadvertent change. It's what we became world changers without knowing that we were world changers. And that sort of makes sense. You know, when you're an animal acting in the world, and then you develop more powerful skills to manipulate your local environment, you don't imagine that you can change the world. The world is the world. It's this immutable realm that you live in, you know, and it doesn't make sense that you would be able to change the world, right? So I think the sort of baseline assumption is that you don't have to worry about that. And we, you know, used to just be able to throw things away, right? Toss it in the ocean. The ocean's infinite, you know. Dilution is the solution to pollution and all that, right? But the problem, of course, there is no away. right? Ultimately, mm-hmm. once we become globally distributed, we, you know, that thing you threw away, somebody else finds it or it comes back to you. And so that shocking realization that the world is finite and that our actions are changing it, it's understandable that we had to sort of catch up to that. And that the dilemma is when we are acting on a larger realm than our awareness, you think of a child needing to develop situational awareness and being clumsy because they don't realize that the powers that they have, or, you know, bull in the china shop, where, you know, you have powers that you're not in control of and not aware of. So I see us sort of cognitively at that level where our influence exceeds the realm of our perception and our awareness. And that is dangerous and unstable. But when, on the other hand, when we develop what I call global intelligence or true intelligence or planetary intelligence, it's when we actually are incorporating that awareness of our global effects into our actions on that scale. That's the solution to the Anthropocene dilemma. And that can actually switch things around to make those same powers very powerful tools to assure longevity and assure survival, not just of the human, of our civilization, but even of other species that we share the world with. So I think we can sort of turn things around to the extent that we are able to expand that awareness and act on that knowledge.
Right. And talk a bit more about geoengineering. You said that you're quite skeptical of its, you know, even trying it out. Why is it so potentially dangerous to try geoengineering to save our planet from climate change?
Because we don't know enough. And climate is very, very complex, and our best models do not yet reflect the full complexity of the way the world works. And so, for example, one of the solutions that's discussed is solar radiation management, which most commonly people talk about injecting particles of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, mimicking what happens, you know, when there's a big volcanic eruption, things will cool for a couple of years sometimes because the stratosphere gets filled with these aerosols, these little particles of sulfur dioxide. So why can't we do that and make the climate cool? Well, there's a couple problems with that. For one thing, it doesn't solve the problem of ocean acidification. The CO2 still builds up in the atmosphere, and the coral reefs still die. And you know, it's almost like if it becomes an excuse to keep emitting CO2, then yeah, you may cool the climate, but the other problems CO2 causes still get worse. But even worse than that, we can't really predict the detailed global effects, and it probably would have a huge influence on precipitation patterns, and you may well get crop failures and droughts. In fact, the closest analog is when we have had huge volcanic eruptions, and the historical record shows that the years following those, yeah, things cooled down a little bit, but it also caused massive famines because there were places where the rains did not come, the monsoons did not come, and crops died off. So I think, you know, we're sort of playing with something that we don't understand. And it's really not the way to go. I do feel like our goal in the long run should be to understand the Earth system much more deeply and understand our potential to interact with it much more deeply. And there may come a day, I think there will come a day, when we see things happening to the planet that we legitimately want to sort of stave off. I mentioned ice ages. You know, the climate does fluctuate. But that's a long way off. And I think that we would only make things worse. We're still in that dilemma where we don't understand things fully enough. Acting in a realm where you don't understand the consequences is, especially when you're dealing with the only home you've got.
Right, there's just no planet B.
It's
yes.
Not a good recipe. You know, it's not a good way to go.
Got it. Talk about the role, we're here in Silicon Valley, talk about the role of artificial intelligence and technology in helping perhaps understand the planet better, and what other role artificial intelligence can play in helping solve this climate change problem.
Yeah, well, it's the question of AI, artificial intelligence, is a really interesting one, and I get into it a little bit in the book. And, you know, people talk about this there's potential for a singularity where all of a sudden machines are going to get so intelligent that they'll invent faster machines, and they'll invent faster machines, and evolution will take off in some way that we just completely become obsolete, and humans are just then an afterthought. And it is revealed that our purpose on Earth was really to invent the real intelligent creatures. That's possible. I don't actually expect that. I think, I also cannot say that it's impossible, but I think the people that believe in that, and for some people it's almost like a techno-rapture, a religious kind of belief, I think, sorry, you and you who are, you know, no, it's based on an idea, an untested idea about the nature of consciousness, that if you just hook up enough processors and they're fast enough, that all of a sudden, that's what consciousness takes. But we don't understand consciousness. We don't. It's a huge mystery. So if that's right, if that idea is right, then that could happen. But I'm sort of not really expecting that. But what I do expect is that obviously machines are getting more capable and smarter and able to do cognitively a lot of what human beings have uniquely been able to do. And, you know, that obviously that presents some huge risks, but also some huge opportunities. I mean, definitely it's going to lead to huge economic disruption. And I think we're going to have to really reexamine this sort of Puritan notion that everybody should have a job and that you don't deserve to have a livelihood if you're not doing a job. There aren't going to be as many jobs. I think that that may be okay because we just have to change the assumptions of our economic system. That's a longer discussion. But as far as the potential to help us solve these problems, I think that's very real too. If anything, what we need is some ability to be more globally interconnected in some of the key ways in which we respond to the changes we see happening on the planet, including many that we're inducing. And it doesn't require some perfect utopian world government, obviously. I mean, the example of ozone that I gave, I think, is a good one. It just requires some level of global coordination of perceived self-interest.
Can you explain that, the Montreal Protocol you're talking about? Can you just explain for people who are not familiar with that? Because some people have said that that is a model for how we can deal with climate change.
Absolutely, I think it is. It's not a perfect model, but it certainly shows we have the capacity. The Montreal Protocol was the agreement, the global agreement to phase out the CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, the chemicals that were destroying the ozone layer. You know, when those chemicals were introduced, they were hailed as these environmentally safe, wonderful products, and they were better than what they replaced. You know, before that, for refrigeration, people used things like ammonia that were really poisonous and toxic and horrible. And then here are these inert chemicals that can't react with anything. They're perfectly safe. Chlorofluorocarbons, they're great. We're very clever, but they weren't quite clever enough, because what happens is, yeah, they're perfectly inert and safe down here in the troposphere where we live, but when they start to build up in the atmosphere and filter up to the stratosphere, you know, 10 miles up, there the ultraviolet light from the sun changes them and rips off the chlorine atoms and does starts to mess with the ozone. Who would have anticipated that? You know, so we're just not quite clever enough. But the good thing is that once we saw that happening, there was a big global discussion about it. And there was a lot of pushback. There were governments, companies said that it was fraudulent. And a lot of the same things that are happening now, people said that the science was fake, and that companies pushed back, and companies even paid scientists to produce disinformation, just as happened now. It's sort of parallel. But yet the truth won out, and there were global agreements made, and those chemicals were phased out. So it shows we can do it. Now, of course, it's not a perfect analogy because, when you think of fossil fuels, much more of our world economy depends on that. It would cause a much more huge economic disruption to just say, oh, we're going to stop using those, which ultimately we have to do. So it's a bigger problem, but I think the model, it shows, it's a proof of concept. It shows we have that capacity.
Wonderful. Yes, a bit of optimism. So we have a good number of questions from the audience. I'll try and get through as many as I can. First is, how best can we survive the next 4 years with an with an anti-science, global warming denying Trump presidency?
Yeah, it's a great question. And obviously, you know, I don't have a perfect answer to that. it's a challenging time. But I have a few things to say about it. One is that we don't know, of course, what the new administration is going to do. Nobody does. They don't even know. You know, he doesn't even have any ideas, let alone have bad ideas. It's just, I don't think. But that's not necessarily comforting because, you know, some of these people getting appointed have ideas, and they're not necessarily good ones. But I think it is true that the president does not have that much leverage on climate issues. We saw that over the last 8 years in a sort of disappointing way, where, you know, we had a president who was saying a lot of the right things and was not able to do that much about climate. A lot of the action now is at state and local levels. That's where a lot of the innovation. I mean, California hopefully will keep racing ahead with what you guys are doing, all kinds of valuable innovations that aren't coming from the federal government. It's also true that there are inevitable economic forces that cannot be stopped by bad policy right now, which is fortunate. I mean, coal is on its way out. It doesn't matter what somebody says during the campaign. It's just not economically competitive anymore, and that's wonderful. You know, those miners, we need to help them, and they need to retrain and find something to do. You know, we should care about them, but we're not going to send them back into the mines to keep digging coal. It's on its way out. And solar and wind are going to keep getting cheaper. Yeah, it'd be nice if we could help them with subsidies, and it'd be nice to have enlightened policy, but that's just not all going to halt. We are not the whole world here in the United States. It's too bad if we can't be more of a leader. But frankly, I think the Chinese are about to really step up on this problem because they need to, because their cities have become unlivable because of air pollution. And that's really an interesting possibility because for all the failings of a very centralized, autocratic, technocratic oppressive government, they do have the ability to really move something like energy policy rapidly if they want to, and they want to now. So we have to realize that we're not the whole world. We have to hunker down and get through this 4 years, if it is going to be 4 years. I'm not convinced it is. I'm very concerned. I share the concern of the writer there. But, you know, it's also true that history is very nonlinear and things get catalyzed. And I actually see a kind of awakening happening now. We've been maybe too complacent. And I know scientists. I was just at the AGU meeting, the American Geophysical Union meeting this morning with 24,000 earth scientists. And scientists are riled up. Everybody's talking about this. Everybody's buzzing. And
so you see it as a unifying force, in fact?
It could be. I mean, I don't want to say, yay, this is great. Thank you, Mr. Orange guy. But I do see reaction being catalyzed. And, you know, sometimes that happens in history, that in response to a threat, we rise and become our best selves.
And if you had the opportunity to sit down with Donald Trump or his new EPA chief or Department of Environment chief, what is your one message you would give them as a scientist?
Yeah, that's a tough one too. But I have had that experience, not with those people you mentioned, but I have through my appointment at the Library of Congress, I did have the opportunity to sit down with a couple of pretty conservative Republican Tea Party representatives. It was challenging, but I did find that something that kind of worked was talking to them from a different perspective, not just saying, let's talk about this issue that you and I disagree on, and I'm going to tell you why you're wrong and I'm right, but sort of edging into it. And with this one guy, he was really into space exploration and wanted to talk to me about that. And we had a pretty good conversation about that, and then, but I kind of wanted to ease the conversation into climate, but because I knew he had this position that I, but I didn't. But then I sort of got into it actually by talking about Venus and greenhouse warming there, and saying, well, yeah, we really need to keep exploring these planets, because obviously we need to, you know, cut down the uncertainty in our climate models and do a better job of. And he was like nodding and agreeing with me, and I was like, you know, I don't know if, I don't think I changed his position on it, but I did feel like I was at least maybe sort of poking around and finding some way to communicate. It's a very difficult problem
finding common ground.
Yeah,
maybe if it's
a
job maker for Donald Trump, that would help.
Absolutely,
right?
But you know, that's one thing I didn't mention in response to the question before, is that if people really care about the economy, like they claim to, and competitiveness, then there's also room there to reach them, because there are just very good, very conservative economic arguments as to why we need to be leaders in changing our energy system now. So that's another angle too. Is like, well, forget about whether you and I agree about climate modeling, but let's just talk about the economy and what's good for it anyways.
Good. Good. Another audience question. What's your opinion on Stephen Hawking's opinion that the Earth has 1,000 years before we need to colonize another planet? And similar question, what do you think of Elon Musk's plan for Mars? What will happen?
What will happen? Well, let me... did I bring my crystal ball? I think I left it in my briefcase. Stephen Hawking is a brilliant, brilliant guy. He knows a lot about black holes and cosmology. He doesn't know anything more about what the world's going to be like in 1,000 years than you do, or you do. We have this tendency to think that people are sages because they're really smart about one thing, and then think they know about everything. And I don't mean to diss Stephen Hawking at all. He's a very, very impressive person. He's a genius. His personal story is amazing. But when somebody like that makes a pronouncement about, oh, we've got 1,000 years left, let's start packing the spaceship. No, there's no basis for that. And I actually think that's a danger. Well, dangerous maybe too. It's not helpful. It's wrong, and it's sort of a misdirection from the way we need to be thinking about our planet. We're going to still be here in 1,000 years, or our descendants are, and it's better to figure out how to keep the planet livable than, Mars is never going to be an escape from Earth. I do think I'm very attached to the romance of space exploration, and I do think that ultimately, and this is one thing I agree with Elon Musk about, that it is our destiny to become a multi-planet species, but not at the expense of abandoning Earth or thinking we can use up Earth and then go live somewhere else. That's just silly. I think part of the value of thinking about going to live on other planets is we explore the way we approach interacting with the planet. And when you think about how we would survive on Mars, it makes us really think about how do we survive on Earth? What are our needs? How do you interact with the planet? You know, and I think there's a healthy way in which it can sort of expand our repertoire of how to cope, but not as an escape. And similarly, I would say Elon Musk is a very brilliant and impressive person, and I agree with a lot of what he says, but not everything. This plan to terraform Mars by nuking the polar caps, that's just ridiculous. And it's not original or new. It's something that some scientists at NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, modeled 20 years ago and realized it was ridiculous and sort of abandoned it. So it's actually a resurrection of a not very good idea for terraforming Mars. There are much, much more elegant ways to think about doing it than by nuking it.
Interesting. And what about the timeline for getting to Mars? Do you see that happening within our lifespan?
I see the likelihood that people will walk on Mars within our lifespan, assuming we stay healthy and eat our vegetables and exercise regularly. As far as a self-sustaining, independent colony there, It could happen, but I think that there are probably ways in which that will be much more challenging than we expect. You know, looking at the experience of Biosphere 2, and they couldn't even do it in Arizona, you know, let alone Mars. I think it's a worthwhile thing to attempt to model, to think about. It makes you think about biospheres and recycling and how it would work, and you uncover hidden problems in our understanding of these systems. I think it's a bold and beautiful dream, you know. Not if it takes so much resources that it really ends up depriving people on Earth of basic needs. But I don't think it has to. I think there's a way to do it in which it's sort of an inspiring extension of what we do here on Earth. But I'm not holding my breath. I think I do think people will go to Mars fairly soon. But I think as far as like being able to really achieve some self-sustaining colony, I bet it's going to be more difficult than we think. And that in the process of trying, we'll actually learn a lot that's useful.
Good. Another audience question. We're on the edge of a climate cliff that we will fall off soon. What climate event will wake humanity up and avoid this planetary disaster?
I think the cliff is actually a bad metaphor. I'm very concerned about climate, and I think that we have to do everything we can to mitigate and avoid the worst case scenarios. But the problem with the cliff metaphor, people have likened it to an asteroid. And it's not a good metaphor either, because an asteroid's either going to hit or it doesn't, and there's a moment when it's hit, and then it's game over. With climate, there's not a moment. There's a whole series of trajectories of
paths. But isn't there a tipping point, though?
Well, there are potential tipping points. And we really don't know. And there's some very simple models that suggest, you know, there are things like the methane in the northern regions that could start to release, and then that could be a positive feedback. But it's horribly complex. There are a lot of positive and negative feedbacks. People talk about the collapse of the Antarctic ice sheets and how sea level could rise by, 15 meters or something. But, yeah, it can, but in, like, 10,000 years. And I think in that kind of time scale, we'll know how to deal with it. So the way I look at climate is this. I think that by the 22nd century, we will be completely off fossil fuels. Our climate will be stabilized. We'll look back on this time and we'll go, can you believe what idiots our ancestors were driving around in these cars? And, you know, it wasn't that hard. And look at the damage they did. We know now that there's a better way to do this. We're going to get from here to there. And it's a question of, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. How much damage are we going to do? And I see the bad scenarios are that the 21st century will be as bad as the 20th century. And people say, oh, what are you talking about? The 20th century wasn't bad. Well, it wasn't for you. For the 100 million people who died in famines and wars, and it wasn't that great. And it's that scale of tragedy that we're facing. It's not a cliff. It's a repeat of the tragedies, the scale of tragedies of the 20th century. And it doesn't have to be that bad if we get our act together. It's a whole series of possible trajectories from here to there. There is a there. There will be a post-fossil fuel world. It will be somewhat different. Damage will have been done, and our task, therefore, is to minimize the damage and the pain and the displacement in getting from here to there. I don't mean to downplay the scale, but I think the notion that there's a moment by which it's just done is actually sort of wrong and not that helpful.
Right. Talk about the role of NASA's climate research. That is under threat right now, we understand.
Yeah, well, it could be. Again, it's one of these things that's been floated. There's one of the advisors to the transition team of the new administration in an interview, made a very strong statement about how NASA should stop studying the Earth and should only send rockets into space and study faraway things. And, you know, that's ridiculous. It's very naive. It's you know, it's based on a you know, if what you know about NASA comes from some picture book your parents gave you when you were 9 years old, you might think that all that NASA does is send rockets into space and study distant planets. But in fact, from its inception, NASA has also been about studying the Earth and its atmosphere and its surface from space. Space-based observations of Earth are a key part of what NASA does. And frankly, we couldn't do a good job of studying other planets without those space-based observations. And without them, we would also just be, you know, we'd be blinding ourselves. It's not just about climate change. It's about protection against natural disasters and ability to grow crops and have productive fisheries. And, you know, it's the space-based study of the Earth has become an essential tool for living well on this planet. And, you know, it would be tragic and ridiculous if the United States stepped away from that. You know, they talk about, well, if NASA doesn't do it, there'll be other agencies that could, but there aren't. There's nobody. I mean, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, is tiny compared to NASA, and they depend on NASA for a lot of their technology and their space-based observations. And frankly, if NASA stopped doing it, if you want to know who would do it, it would be the Chinese and the Europeans and the Japanese, and it would just accelerate the you know, sort of United States receding from global leadership. But that would be tragic. And actually, I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's a trial balloon. There's a lot of pushback. There's a lot of outcry. I mean, we'll see. I mean, you know, I'm kind of like, we're all kind of girding ourselves to see what really happens. But I talked to someone who, actually yesterday, who's kind of high up at NASA, and I was talking to him about this, and I almost winked and said, don't worry about it. And I couldn't tell if he was just being an optimist or he knows something I don't know, but I'm concerned about this, but I'm not yet...
You're not in panic mode
yet. I don't believe it.
Right.
If I'm proven wrong, then, you know, we're going to have to get a million scientists to march on the mall in Washington. You know, but
that's a great image. That's a
great
question.
Yeah. So I'd be there leading it.
So it's time to wrap up our program. Unfortunately, it's gone past fast, but I'd like to end on a positive note. And I'd love, David, if you could read from your book, Earth in Human Hands. We discussed in the green room a couple of short paragraphs that are a bit of a call to action. And as I say, we'd like to end on a positive note.
Yeah, so this is right near the end of the final section, Embracing the Human Planet. Nobody knows the odds of our being able to navigate the evolutionary obstacles before us, but there is a real hope. And it is this, that our evolving technological capacities can allow us to maximize our innate social prowess, equipping us to meet the novel threats we have accidentally created and to become something new in the process. We have done this before. From this cosmic vantage point on our own evolutionary history and our current global situation, we have the option to choose the future we want and, with self-awareness, bravery, and humility, to reach for the wheel of history and steer a path toward infinite potential. Then the next enlightenment can begin, when we learn how to live well within a finite world, with ourselves as its conscious shapers. We can embrace Earth as human beings, creative, cooperative, imaginative, storytelling, engineering, problem solvers. We can care for our planet and begin to contemplate our galactic destiny.
I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Dr. David Grinspoon, senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute and author of Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. Our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and the web. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you.